Hi, and welcome back, everyone, to Couch Confidentials, episode number 6, brought to you by Martech Therapy. I'm your host, Matthew Niederberger, and today we have a pleasure of spending time to talk to Stefan Hamel. Stefan is a seasoned digital analytics consultant and educator with over 30 years of experience in the field. He has held various roles, including serving as a lecturer at Université Laval and working as a freelance consultant. Stefan is known for his contributions to the digital analytics community for years, including the creation of the infamous Digital Analytics Maturity Model, who doesn't remember that? And he's been recognized as a leading voice in the industry with a strong presence on LinkedIn and other professional platforms. So thank you for your time today, Stefan, and welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me, Matthew. That's a pleasure.
Yeah, and I think we got the conversation started before we really dive into the topic around privacy, because I know that's kind of the main topic you're working on, privacy and ethics. I just kind of want to rewind to where we met, and I had to do a little digging. I think I had I was doing video recording at the time as a kind of a side project as well, called Time for 10, and we met at a web analytics summit in Amsterdam. But we have to kind of paint the picture. This was at the time when Web Trends was still a leading company.
Oh boy.
That's a long time ago.
That's a long time ago. Maybe I didn't have gray hair.
I think my hairline was down a little bit lower as well. But I think anyone in the analytics industry can say that as well. I mean, even Julien Coquet, we always used to make jokes about how do you recognize a web analyst, and that's with the receding hairline. So it's good to see you again. I mean, we've spoken a lot on LinkedIn, and I've kind of seen you move from being an active participant in the digital analytics world to moving into teaching. And now you're really popping up and being very vocal about privacy and ethics. And the topic where we kind of got talking again in more in depth was Profado AI's State of Privacy Report 2024.
Yeah.
And I think their statement was that 75% of the websites, you know, on average on US and Europe are non-compliant. And I think you were the one who said, well, it's probably a lot higher.
Based on my absolutely, you know, non-scientific reviews, it's probably like 100%.
Wow.
Yeah, well, especially in the U.S. and in Canada. Well, the U.S. is a mess on so many fronts.
Don't get me started on that one.
My interest is obviously mostly about Canada, because that's where I live. And sadly, there was a regulation that was supposed to get approval from the parliament. And now with the changes, the elections coming up, that regulation is basically just dead.
Yeah.
So each province is left to decide how they want to handle privacy. And Quebec, where I live, is something that is actually very, very close to GDPR. But there were multiple phases, and the latest phase was just this year in September. Companies are really, really slow to get it, like to see that it's not just constraints and pain in the butt and stuff like that, but really see it as an opportunity to rethink their marketing and rethink the way they are doing business. I guess similar to what happened in Europe a couple of years ago, where until there are clear cases that make noise in the industry or fines, companies are just like, you know, it's risk management. What's the risk? Pretty much zero. So we have other things to do. So let's put that aside, check the boxes and say, oh yeah, do we have a consent banner? Yes, we do. It's not actually doing anything, but we have a consent. You know, things like that. So honestly, I've been struggling to make my voice heard here in terms of really, I'm very vocal. I'm sharing a lot. I'm showing examples and stuff like that. You know what? Actually, it's not generating any business, because companies are either working with lawyers, working on the privacy policy. Yes, you need a consent banner, but oftentimes the lawyers are obviously not opening the hood and looking technically how it's working.
Yeah.
So when I do audits, I find a ton of issues that are just slipping through. So I was expecting to be swamped by a huge amount of requests and work and so on, but it's actually not the case. I'm actually spending more time looking on my own, looking at businesses or through my own experience dealing with, you know, just recently there was I purchased new furniture and the delivery person simply asked for a voice confirmation on his phone.
Oh, wow. I've never heard that one before.
Yeah. So it's essentially using biometrics in a way that is not to authenticate you, but just you just have to say, yes, this is me and I'm okay with the delivery.
And did you have to state your name?
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. That brings back vibes of Enemy of the State with
we hear so many stories about the voice cloning,
yeah,
and fraud and stuff like that. So I was quite surprised, and when I looked at the policy, yes, on the website it says we're using voice to confirm your delivery, and that goes back to the times of COVID, where you know contacts, yeah, and everything, but it's not the case anymore. So is it proportional? Is it acceptable to record the voice? So I guess if there was an issue later on, they would dig back the recording and say, yes, this was you. You said you were okay. So it's like, okay, it's not marketing per se. It's not related to the website, but it's a personal experience that, oh, wait a minute. That's voice is a biometric and it's pretty sensible. It's pretty easy to clone these days. So I reached out to the company, and of course, the answer is, oh no, we abide by every law, and we're okay, and we take privacy very seriously, of course.
What was your main concern at the time about your voice? Is it more like storage or the security around?
I have no clue. I have no clue about the storage, the security, how long they're going to keep it, what they're going to do exactly with it. I don't know. If it's on the delivery guy phone, happens with it?
Yeah.
I have no clue. So there are just so many examples like this where we take things for granted and we're uneducated largely.
Yeah.
I'm aware of privacy, so I can't imagine all the other people who just say, oh, yes, this is my name, and they will record. Maybe it's just a short recording, but
yeah,
it's not necessarily the fact that, is it useful? Yeah, okay. Instead of signing something, is it better? Maybe yes, maybe no. But it's just in the of developing the kind of the sensibility both for the customer and the,
yep,
organization to think about what they're doing and what are the consequences. And right now, I think Canada is behind Europe in terms of those kind of being more sensitive and sensible about that, and obviously far behind if we think about the U.S.
Yeah. And I was going to, so many questions in my mind. It's incredible, the experience. But I was, so this afternoon, I was thinking about, you know, our call here today. And one of the topics I was going to try to avoid was the political one. But you probably saw the video yesterday with a surfer boy, Zuckerberg, with his burnt nose and his curly hair, claiming that, well, he's pretty much bowing down to the powers that be. I mean, your experience is from Canada. It's still Canada today. We don't know a few months from now.
Crossing my fingers.
Yeah, exactly. But it's interesting to see. I'm trying to find comparisons between Europe, Canada, and U.S. You mentioned that on a national level, the
yeah,
plans have stalled because of Trudeau,
yeah,
stepping back and new,
yeah,
elections being announced. But and then everything's being dealt on a provincial level. I think that's comparable to Europe on as a union and then individual countries,
yeah,
but also in the US. Is it also safe to say that the lack of knowledge around privacy, the potential dangers around misuse of personal data due to the incorrect implementation of consent methods, the storage, retention, is that going to be I didn't want to go that political route. Is that going to kind of further divide countries even more, or provinces in your case? You say,
yeah,
Quebec is a little bit more advanced than the rest. Yeah. Is that going to split the divide even more? That lack of understanding?
Yeah, I think so. Because, well, one of the events that really was significant in Quebec is that the largest financial institution, they had a huge data leak of, I think it was 8 or 9 million records. So it's essentially almost the whole population of the province, because it's the largest financial institution. It has a long history. And the data leak actually happened because of someone who was working in marketing internally for that institution.
Oh, wow.
And it's been going on for years. So of course, following that huge data leak, it was a wake up call. So it was this institution. It could have been any other one because that was an internal job. And of course, there were a lot of details about financials and personal information, things like that. And it ended up on the dark web. So now we're all at risk for until we die.
Yeah.
Actually, I woke up one morning, I went to here in Canada and like in the US, we have credit companies that put a score on you and stuff like that. And so I went to my TransUnion account and saw that I had a loan, $25,000 loan on a car, and my home address was changed. So where did the data come from? Where did the fraud, what was the source? Was it financial institution or was it something?
Could be something. Yeah.
And where was the process to ensure that somewhere, and it was for a bank that I never did any business. So there was something in the process that didn't work, obviously, because they didn't check, they changed my home address. So suddenly I was not living in the same province anymore.
Oh, that's creepy.
What didn't work? So I tried to, of course, call TransUnion, get that cleared up, and then call the bank, and they were all confused. I had to call multiple times, wait on the line. It's very frustrating. Like, you're the victim here in that scenario, but you have to waste your time. You have to prove that you are who you are and that you didn't actually take that phone and so on. It might happen anytime in the future.
I love that statement, though. You're the victim, but you need to spend time and money and resources because of their neglect of privacy safety. Wow. Yeah, that's...
And the joke is, when you talk to the bank and you say, well, can I know where was the issue? How come you accepted to give a loan without doing the proper validation
for
the address and stuff like that? No, it's confidential.
Yeah.
That's actually the reply that we got. So it simply doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
And all of that, another example is I rented a truck, a moving truck, several years ago. And of course, they had to check my driver's license. But they actually took a copy and they kept it. And years later, they had a data leak.
Oh, geez.
Of course, all of that was available. So it's just, multiple occasions. So it's we cannot look at privacy in isolation of this is marketing and this is something else. It's part of the whole customer experience.
Yeah.
If there's a process that involves scanning your driver's license, maybe there's a real purpose. There's a real utility to do that because you don't want to rent a truck to the wrong person or, you need some guarantee and stuff like that.
Yeah.
You don't need to keep the data, but it's part of the same customer experience. And if years later you find out that your data was leaked and you receive a nicely written email that says, your privacy is very important to us, but
sure,
we have a data leak.
Wow, that's incredible. I mean, it's like being stuck between a rock and a hard place. And I want to say that people is the government. But we'll take that with a grain of salt. But we have big tech on one end, especially what we're seeing now in the U.S., that they're just trying to hammer or even use political pressure to kind of threaten the EU. So from an EU perspective, we're seeing, hey, if you start censoring or regulating X or Twitter or Zitter or whatever, we're going to step out of NATO.
Yeah.
Where is this going to end? I mean, on the one hand, what I feel within Europe is that we've become very aware of the power of privacy and our own controls, and there are government apps on our phone that say, hey, if you need, example with your driver's license, if you need to send a company the picture of your driver's license, use this app, and what it will do is kind of black bar the essential information like your social security number.
Yeah.
from that photo, and then it'll give you a version that's been redacted and safe enough for you to share. Wow,
yeah, that makes sense.
The leakage of a photo of your driver's license, it's pretty crazy. But where do you as a individual, you're taking on this fight, this challenge, you're chasing these companies down. Companies, I think, from their perception say, or from their view say, hey, it's not doing anything to our bottom line. So why should we invest in it? It's not giving us more profit, more loss.
Of course, they say, you know, we're okay. We follow the regulation. We follow the law. Of course, to me, in an email, they will never admit to wrongdoing because I could use that to sue them or whatever. But my intent when I publish something and I'm working on 5 top media companies in Quebec, all in French.
I thought you were going to say the digital privacy maturity model. Sorry.
Yeah. Well, I thought about that.
Really? Okay.
Oh, yeah. Because if you take the maturity model that I created that like 20 years ago, something like that, you could almost take exactly the same dimensions about governance, about the objectives, about the resources, the scope, the technology, because you need a lot of technology to manage privacy. You could take those same dimensions and create some level on each of those dimensions and say, well, is data governance still makes sense, of course, with privacy. Is it properly handled? What is the state? Do you have the right resources? Are they properly trained? Which is a huge part of privacy also.
Yeah, yeah.
So it still makes sense. You just change analytics maturity model for privacy maturity model. It fits almost perfectly.
We're going back to your five institutions. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Which were governance. So what is the governance of your data privacy? The scope and objectives. So what are you trying to do? And how do you do it and stuff like that? Do you have the proper resources internally or externally? Are they properly trained and stuff like that? What is the process? Again, it goes pretty much to governance. But what is the, what are the processes to handle privacy? And the last one was technology. And it's funny because I went to a privacy conference where most of the audience were lawyers and stuff like that. And someone on the keynote said, you know what, the legal department is going to spend more on IT than IT itself. And it was exactly the same statement that we heard years ago about marketing.
Yeah.
When people were saying, oh, marketing is going to spend more on technology than IT. And now, from a legal perspective, that's a statement also that you need to have proper technology to manage all of it. So it adds the complexity of it. So back to what you were saying about, you know, the state of the US, Canada, Europe, and polarization and stuff like that. We saw Zuckerberg saying, oh, no, there won't be, you know, we're going to embrace the X approach of not doing valid fact check. And stuff like that.
It's scary.
It's scary. Yeah, it is scary. And something that started as a joke that Canada is the 51st state. Well, you know,
is that an ongoing joke in Canada?
There was someone also out west who was saying that Ukraine was Putin won't do anything and it's not serious. And well, that's not the kind of things that you should joke with. And the sad thing is, I
agree, but I was working with a company at the time. Sorry to interrupt.
And sure.
We had these Ukrainian developers, and this was at the time of the buildup before Russia actually committed their crimes. And I was like, are you okay over there? Even one guy was in Zaporizhia where they have the nuclear power plant. And and they were pretty laid back. It's like, this kind of, you know, every day thing. We know they're there, but they're not going to. I haven't heard from them since, and it's worrying on one end. But yeah, with Canada, I'm not sure how real. I mean, what's the Canadian sentiment? I'm not going to turn this into a political podcast, but what's the sentiment now after those kind of?
Yeah, well, there's like you said, there's probably some polarization. You know, Quebec has from an historical standpoint, has been maybe closer to Europe, while the English-speaking part of Canada, it's a lot easier to be closer to the U.S. culture. So right there, there are some different opinions and stuff like that. But I think generally, people are saying, no, we don't actually want to be part of the U.S., for so many reasons. And just like, Greenland and the, you know, why?
Yeah. I've read a few posts on LinkedIn. There were quite a few good ones that passed by. I really wish that I could get a political filter on LinkedIn so I could switch it off and just focus on business like we're doing now. But I you know, with the support of big tech and giving them the platforms to spread this information, reduce fact checking, I'm actually quite happy to be living in Europe, and that these, maybe it might sound crazy to some Americans or Americans who are very on the capitalistic route, so to say, and free enterprise, et cetera. But I'm glad that there is protection for me as a citizen of Europe. And I live in the Netherlands. I was a U.S. citizen, but I denounced my citizenship purely for tax reasons. But I really feel safe in Europe. And it's so difficult to say how that will turn out to be.
Yeah.
In the U.S., they're going to know everything. Sure. I mean, if we go back to analytics now, and privacy attribution is difficult. It's very hard. With third-party data, all the regulations around that, it's very difficult. But we just don't know what is going to happen with our data. We don't even know what Google's doing with our data, let alone if we get rid of all the regulations and let big tech do their thing.
Yeah.
You could probably write privacy, you know, you could probably delete it from the dictionary at that point.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, one of the, my shift toward privacy was gradual, and one of the turning points, besides, you know, my data being leaked and so on. Before that, I went to a conference in Europe, and a bit at the last minute, I was asked to do a Q&A on stage with Christopher Wiley, the Cambridge Analytica whistleblower. But I also spent 45 minutes stage with him.
Yeah,
a very special guy, brilliant and everything. And I had two things that I was wondering. One is, well, the first one is, he become the whistleblower because he had a change of heart and that was the right thing to do? Or was it because a journalist was running after him for a year and she was about to come out with the story? So he didn't have really a choice, but he never really answered that. But he was very honest and transparent, but, you know, that was after the fact. The other thing that the other realization is that there's very little difference between marketing and propaganda. There's very little difference between selling t-shirts or selling an election.
Yeah.
There's very little. So at that conference, I asked the audience, if you were in a marketing role where you have an amazing data scientist team, you have a huge amount of data, you have the money to do whatever you want, and you're going to do campaigns to sell shoes and t-shirts and stuff like that, would you take the job? And of course, in the audience, you know, most of the people said, oh yeah, that's awesome, you know. And then I said, well, switch that and say, instead of t-shirts, you're going to sell a specific individual from a political standpoint. And you still have the very efficient ads, the very efficient data scientists, the data and everything. But now you're going to sell the benefits of electing such person. Would you take the job? And then you saw the ads going down. Not all of them, but many of them. So there is no, in my opinion, there is no real difference. You know, marketing is marketing. Whether you know, try to sell a fridge, we have a saying here, selling fridge to Eskimos. Whether you try to sell a fridge to someone who don't actually need it, it's a bit stereotype, of course, but it's an old saying. My realization was that propaganda is all fine until people realize they've been manipulated. So if you take Cambridge Analytica, the campaign was amazing. The ads were super, super efficient. It was the perfection of advertising and marketing. Everybody liked it. Except when they realize that they've been, well, maybe some people realize they had been manipulated and it didn't change their mind or didn't matter. But with the changes from X and Facebook and so on, and with all the data brokers also who suddenly have even more freedom to do whatever they want, even more than before, then we're all going to be victims of propaganda left and right. It will stop.
No.
And it's going to get way, way worse.
Yeah, and it's going to spread into Europe as well. Yeah, no, exactly. And I've always had this thought in my mind, in that growing up, one of the biggest stories always was cutting wages for teachers, cutting budgets for schools. And I don't want to sound like a conspiracy theorist here, but getting really off course here, but I think that decline in that budget, in being able to educate people to think logically and rationally, is having its effect at an incredible rate right now. So much so that, like you said, the information that you're being shared in combination with AIs, like putting it into overdrive, how are people going to realize what the actual truth is? The complexities on top of that of, who owns the media. I installed an app a few months ago called ground.news. And what I like about it is that you can actually see who owns the media company that is putting out the article. So you can kind of see, how do they lean politically? Yeah. And, and I think there are arguments for both sides. I'm kind of like in the middle, but it's, I don't know. It's a very surrealistic time to be alive. Mm-hmm. And like you said, we're sitting here talking about privacy online. We just kind of dabbled in ethics as well when you talked about the data scientists at the at the event, where people, they're putting their hands down. They're thinking about the consequences of the consequences of their actions. But is it too late? Is there?
You know what? One of the funny things at that same conference is, depending on where you take the data, you will find that in the general population, the use of ad blockers is, some will say 20-30%. So I use, some will say it's even more. But let's say it's 30% of the general population is using an ad blocker. So at that same conference in Europe, where there was over 1,000 people in the audience, and most of them were obviously marketers, I asked, do you use an ad blocker? I didn't count, but I would say roughly it was about 70%.
Use an ad blocker.
70% of marketers are using an ad blocker. So, of course, it's not scientific. I didn't do it. But just from the hands that were raised, that was several years ago. That was pre-COVID and stuff. Yeah, I was like, don't you see there's an issue? Like, if you as a marketer don't want to be served what you impose on others.
Yeah, you want to bake the cake, but you're not going to take a bite from it.
So that was, I had so many of those situations where gradually, I still believe in marketing, of course. It's still it's still an essential element. But I think there are ways of doing marketing that are more respectful. Marketing is about trust. It's about building trust with your customers. And that's in many cases, that's not what happened. So you mentioned, attribution. We thought for a while that attribution was the holy grail of marketing. Oh, without attribution, you're
perfect
dead.
Performance indicator. Where's your money going?
Yeah.
And how's you getting it back? Yeah.
Yeah. And then, there were all cycles of, and these days it's a lot about data clean rooms. Clean rooms. They're going to solve everything. You can do almost as you did before. And it's going to be respectful. It's going to be private. No, actually, that's not the way it works. So, and before that, there was big data. There's always something that makes marketers dream about the perfect scenario. Well, in reality, the perfect, and that's why I like teaching and seeing that the students, when I'm teaching marketing at the MBA level, and seeing that when they enter, it's one of the first courses of their program, and they think marketing is all about influencers on Instagram. I'm joking. But it's almost the
single
real
channel
thing. Single channel, and it's all about virality, and
I think everybody's kids at any kid right now between 18 and 8, I've got two of them in between that age range. They've at least at one point said they want to be an influencer. They want to go on YouTube. Yeah. They want to go on Instagram and, get the likes and the followers.
Yeah. Yeah. 30, 5 years ago, I think, when I was studying in computer science, everybody wanted to work in the gaming industry. And now it's influenced, it's Instagram and TikTok and stuff like that. So I have to kind of wire the thinking in a way that, yeah, sure, influencers, Instagram, that's fine. Back to privacy, when you have a Facebook and a Google, being very, very efficient at telling people, telling marketers to, your tracker, your pixel, if you send us a hashed email or phone number, it's respectful.
No way.
And your marketing is going to be so much better.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a promise. It's
I remember the first time I hashed an email, I was like, yeah, but immediately you have to unhash it unless you're using a custom key. But I was like, when you send data through to Facebook using their conversion API, for instance, it's a standard SHA-256. And I'm like, where's the safety in that?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So there's on the one end, you have the big players who are saying, no, trust us. We're good. We're going to help you improve your marketing. And on the other end, you have, sadly, I think, a generation of marketers who were trained, their sole exposure to marketing was what the Google and Facebook of this world told them was the right way to do it.
Interesting, yeah.
That's why sometimes, I cringe when I see posts on LinkedIn about people saying a university degree is useless, you better get work experience instead. Yeah, okay, I get it. But not all work experience is equal. And not all degrees are equal either, of course. Yeah, it's
is it do you dig the pressure on X and Facebook and Google now as well? Oh, Google to a lesser extent. And I mentioned in a video earlier this week that I said AI is like, I'm glad it's not a drinking game. Every time you say AI, you need to take a shot. But I do have some. It's not alcohol though. AI. Do you think that companies like OpenAI, especially Perplexity, the examples that I've been seeing there, that the response from Facebook and all these other advertising platforms is also kind of a response to the market share that these AI tools are gaining? The example being Perplexity saying, hey, I want to travel to Rome. And not only will it show you information about Rome, but potentially in future, also flight options or hotel options, et cetera.
Yeah, yeah. Probably like they see the risk of status quo. What is Google now? When you do a Google search, you don't search anymore. Clearly, people are asking questions now.
Did you see the example the other day on LinkedIn from this guy who with John Wick 5?
I don't know if it was that, but I saw something going like people are asking very specific questions, and now the challenge, like you said, is what is going to be true in there?
Yeah, and one of the interesting, I'll see if I can share it to you after the after this recording. Is one about John Wick 5. It's already been confirmed that the movie is going to be, it's not going to be made. It's not happening. But there's still a page. Google will show you results telling you about John Wick 5, who's going to be producing it, who's going to be acting in it. But it's all based on fake information, fake data.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
And there's probably already some, snippets of the movie itself that are running around. And it's
probably being
real.
Generated. Yeah.
Yeah.
The fake information now kind of leaking into search results, and this is the theory that I have based on going back to that education discussion, is how are you going to tell the I don't say less educated but the less aware people about the news that they're seeing is most likely fake. And I think that's where the real danger is. And like you said, even with marketing, how are you going to tell these people that they are going to be misled, be it a product or a politics, it comes down to the same thing.
Yeah, and I heard something about, apparently there's a new generation, alpha generation, and then it's going to be beta generation in 2029, I think. It's going to be the beta generation. So the alpha generation is those who are born essentially in sync with the growth of AI. Sorry.
Yeah. And there you go.
But and they will grow in an environment where the reality will be very subjective. where, you know, what is true and what is fake is going to be really, really hard to differentiate. So it's not that they will be less educated or less aware, because it's going to be surrounding them their whole life, unless there's a drastic change somewhere. So we were worried about the generation who grew with the internet and with social media and so on. And we see the impact of that in terms of decision making and in terms of social capabilities and in terms of, you know, a whole psychological impact and stuff like that. So the next generation is like, maybe because we're getting older and maybe our grandparents and parents were saying the same, but I'm worried.
Yeah. Oh yeah, definitely, definitely.
So yeah, it's always interesting to see how in the class there's always an evolution between the first course where they come in thinking that marketing is influencers on Instagram and TikTok, and then by the end of the semester, one of the courses is about privacy and ethics. They realize, I ask them to go into your Facebook profile and see what Facebook thinks are your interests. And you're going to see hundreds of different things, like the rings of Saturn and stuff like that. And I'm like, yeah, man, do I really care about the rings of Saturn? No, I don't think so. But it's there in my profile. So there's artists that I don't even know who they are and stuff like that. So I ask them to take a look around and see what this environment thinks you are. Think about you.
Yeah.
Does it really reflect who you are? And of course, it's a no, it doesn't at all. I think there was a survey that said that it was a couple of years ago. There was a survey that said like 50% of the people didn't even realize that Facebook was collecting so much information about them. And then when they realized, like 30%, it's the opposite, something like 70% are not comfortable with it. And then when they look at their profile, the details, it's like 80% or 85% of them say it doesn't reflect who they are.
Yeah.
So what is marketing when, you know, we worry about attribution and perfect data and stuff like that, when right there, 85% of the people looking at their Facebook profile say it doesn't reflect who I am, my interests, and so on. So why do we worry so much about the data we collect if we're marketing through channels that don't even have the right information?
Yeah.
And if you take
your profile targeting falls flat on its backside, just say
it doesn't actually reflect. Well, there are broad categories like, okay, if you're shopping for a new fridge.
Sure. Male between 36 and 45. I mean, you can.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah. We've gone through, it's a bit sad that when I was working when the web, I was on the internet, but there was no www. There was no website. It came out. It was just for research, you know, academia, yeah, military and stuff like that, government. And I remember actually sending an email to the guys at Yahoo, the two founders, and asking to add our website to their list because they were maintaining it manually. Don't have that email anymore, but I would find
you're going back into history now.
Yeah. And I remember the first, you know, when the AOL and CompuServe and stuff like that, you know, which were
CompuServe,
yeah, big BBSs, and people suddenly had access to the internet and to the web, and we were thinking, okay, that's the end of it because all the newbies are gonna come, right? And then the ads. So the sad is that the model for advertising on the web simply borrowed what was existing at the time on TV, radio, and paper.
Yeah.
It's like you have an audience, you broadcast.
Yeah, you copy 101 and see if it works. Yeah.
Yeah. If right from the start, the control of what are my interests had been in the power on the side of the consumer, the user, the whole industry, the whole experience would have been totally different.
Yeah. Do you think there's still a chance though?
Well, we see there are companies that are working on zero party data, but through zero party data. Not, it's funny when I see the definition of zero party data is data that the consumer willingly gave to a brand.
Yeah. Right?
And And we see a lot of brands and marketers that are finding or trying to find ways to collect more personal data. That's not the point. Zero-party data is data that the customer control.
Yeah.
And they decide who they give it to. So my ideal scenario, if I own a dog, I will do business with a vet, a store, probably the city to have a permit or something, the insurance company, they need to know if I have a dog. It's still the same dog, but there's at least four different entities that need to get information, and they don't need the same information. The insurance doesn't care about the name of the dog. The vet, maybe they care about it. And the size, the breed, what they eat, what the dog is eating. It's still the same entity, but it's different partners, different brands or different entities with whom we need to share the information. In a zero-party data, the way it's actually defined, each of those four will have different copies of different versions of the truth. They will have their own view of the same dog. But if it was really true, zero-party data, I would control the data, and sadly, the day the dog passed away,
sorry,
I just have one thing to do.
Yeah,
it's delete the data.
Yeah,
and it deletes all of them. So the way it works actually is with the claim of zero-party data and stuff like that. The way it works is as a consumer, risk surface keeps increasing. Because each of those brands are trying to collect more data.
Yeah.
They are finding creative ways to say, oh, yeah, we need, you know, trust us. Your privacy is very important to us. Give us a little bit of your life and we're going to take care of it. And then we lose control. Like I use 1Password to manage my password.
Yeah.
I have hundreds and hundreds of different accounts everywhere. That's my risk surface. The likelihood that one of them is going to have a data leak is 100%. It's going to happen again, as it did in the past. And we don't have much control. So I've grown much more sensitive about that. Even if I continue to obviously use the internet and the web, and I'm still on Facebook, but I don't know how long I'm going to be there.
Yeah.
And I'm still on LinkedIn.
And there's a company out there with your voice and now also this podcast recording. But coming back to responsibility, I think there's a quote somewhere that I read some time about living in a democracy is about being accountable or being responsible. I think is one of those two. And do you think that when you look at the zero party type solution, and I think I've either read it somewhere or had an epiphany somewhere middle of the night saying, oh, maybe this is a solution that you kind of control that data on your own devices. Encrypted with a biometric key that people, you know, and you get to open or checkmark the data that you want to share and control with specific vendors. Yeah, I can just see the resistance of all these big tech saying, oh, no, it's safe with us. But who's going to this responsibility going to lie with? Is it something that the individual needs to wake up to, or should we still be dependent on government entities?
I think it's probably both in the sense that government will take action and enact new laws based on either the abuse on one side or the pressure they get from the consumers. Like in the case of the financial institution, the huge data leak, the government of Quebec didn't have any choice. They had to do something to reassure the population that, yes, there's a limit and we want to protect you. Individually and your privacy. So I think it's probably, there's always, it goes both ways. It comes back somewhere and sometimes the middle is kind of shifting. It's like the North Pole, keeps moving. Yeah. So I think it's both, but sadly, what I see right now is in Quebec, the law is there. The lawyers are working very hard. Some companies are taking it more seriously than others. But what we lack is actual real case example. Here's a scenario.
Oh, but that's always
the case. Here's what is going on. Yeah.
You're not going to put in a speed bump until a kid gets hit by a car to realize, hey, this is a dangerous spot, while the whole community has been shouting
exactly.
For years. Yeah. It's unfortunate that it needs to work that way.
Yeah. And what I realize is that when you talk to, well, first when I post something online on LinkedIn, when I post an article, lawyers will never comment on it because it's part of their training. And yeah. I understand that. Be it here in Quebec or in Europe, lawyers will not comment publicly on, even if it's a fake scenario. Maybe they will, at best, they will give very, broad, article XYZ. They know it by heart, but they won't take a position saying this is the right way or this is the wrong way, because it always depends. They're really good consultants. But at the same time, also companies, obviously, it happened in the past in my articles that I said, this company is doing that.
Yeah.
In my opinion, it's right or wrong. And of course, I add my acronym, IANAL. When you see it written, it sounds a little bit odd, but I'm not a lawyer. Of course, I'm not a lawyer, but everyone is entitled to opinion. And as a consumer, if I do business with such brand, I'm not afraid to mention this company, this experience with them. We leave reviews everywhere. Why are we so shy about sharing our experience and saying, this company did it? It happened also. I will write articles where I say, this company actually did something really good. And sometimes I will say, well, my experience, in my opinion, this and this, it maybe the consent banner is not appropriate. It doesn't give equal choice to consent and reject or things like that.
We're all distracted by Instagram reels and doom scrolling to leave actual reviews on these kind of companies. Hey, listen, Stefan, I know we're kind of coming up to the bottom of the hour. I really want to thank you for your insight. There's light at the end of the tunnel. I think from the experience that you've shared and the work that you're doing in Canada, I hope it picks up, gets more attention. Hope it doesn't come to the point where a disaster happens that affects so many people in bad ways to get this to move. So yeah, thanks for being that focal point then. I really hope that you continue to make great steps in Quebec, preferably nationally, preferably North America. But like I've said before and at the beginning, you've been a great thought leader, a great heart puller, as we say here in the Netherlands, within the community to make people aware of the work that you're doing. And I think you're still doing an amazing job. So thank you very much for your time today.
Yeah. Thanks again for inviting me.
You're welcome. Bye.